Something about standing on a boat, and maybe Lily was there. Or maybe she was both there and not there, in the way that in dreams things can happen on several different planes. I think I was chasing something. Not chasing, hunting. I can't even be certain there was a boat or a dream at all. It all feels less like a dream and more like a memory. Albeit a memory just out of reach. Lily's chest rises and falls again. Her breathing is deep, sonorous. For the first 3 months that she was mine, she did not occupy my bed. She slept in a crate beside me. It started out across the room, but the first several nights she whimpered and whined, unable to sleep away from the warmth of her littermates. Each night, my judgment increasingly affected by my own inability to sleep, I moved the crate a little closer to me, until I could lie with my finger between the bars of the swinging door. We slept like that, side by side, me in a bed, her in a crate, sometimes my finger and her paw touching, until it was time to spay her. After the surgery to remove her uterus, she refused to wear the cone that would keep her from picking at her stitches.
"This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen, and I will take no part in wearing it."
Without the cone, she helped herself to licking at her wound whenever I was not there to stop her. So during the day, I took her everywhere with me, and at night, I brought her into my bed and slept with one arm stretched across her. I don't know that I physically prevented her from pulling at her stitches, but it was an emotional comfort. Enough, at least, that it allowed her to sleep through the night, undistracted by the discomfort of her incision. She never again slept out of my bed, unless we were apart. When her stitches were removed and her wound had healed, I no longer slept with my arm across her. Free to roam the mattress, she immediately burrowed beneath the covers to the very foot of the bed to sleep alongside my feet. Two nights I battled her, convinced of her imminent suffocation if she insisted on sleeping so burrowed. She would tunnel down to the bottom of the bed, and I would drag her back up for air. Then she would tunnel back down to the bottom of the bed, and I would drag her back up for air. We did this for hours, ad nauseam. And late in the second night, I hit my breaking point. "Fine. You want to sleep down there? Then you will suffocate. You will cease being able to breathe. And the last thought you will have in this life is that I was right and you were wrong, and you will go to your grave regretting having a brain the size of a walnut." I lifted the covers and stared down at her, and I could just make out her staring at me. By then I had all but given up trying to out-stubborn a dachshund, an exercise in futility if there ever was one. All I knew was that I was tired, and I needed sleep. I would dig her corpse out of the bed in the morning. Of course, when morning came, she was fine. She trotted up to the cover's edge to greet the daylight, stretching her front legs in some complex yoga pose, and yawning the sleep away. Tonight, it is me who wants to burrow to the foot of the bed, to find the safest spot under the covers, where I can feel small and protected and warm. A spot away from the nightmare of the octopus, away from the reach of his quivering arms, away from what I know is coming next. Sunday night. On Sundays we eat pizza, the one ritual Lily and I have that stems directly from my childhood. When I was a kid, Sunday night was always pizza night. My sister, Meredith, and I would take turns making pizzas with my dad, and it was the one night we were allowed to drink soda. It was something we looked forward to, even though the weekend was drawing to a close. My mother enjoyed it because it was the one break she got from overseeing our endless feedings, something we never fully appreciated. It was not in her nature to put her feet up, however, and she spent the time doing other thankless tasks, like ironing our bedsheets, or using the Otter vacuum attachments to clean under the fridge. My sister and I enjoyed it as something we could do with our dad. Making the pizzas was half the delight, and we had to claim Sundays on the calendar in the kitchen to stake out whose turn it was to help assemble the pies. The event was scored by the game-ending plays of football, or the familiar ticking that starts 60 minutes. I'm Mike Wallace, I'm Morley Safer. I'm Harry Reasoner. And I'm Ed Bradley. Those stories, plus Andy Rooney. Lily and I continue the tradition, although we usually order pizza to be delivered so Lily can bark at the delivery man like a crazed townsperson accusing Goody Proctor of being a witch. I think she looks forward to it, too, even though it's the end of the weekend, the end of the concentrated time we spend together before the craziness of a new week begins. I'm asking Lily if that's what she wants to do, order pizza, when the octopus tightens its foul grip and the first seizure begins. I can tell something is wrong almost immediately, as Lily gets a confused look on her face and starts to back away. And then, without further warning, she stumbles and falls on her side, just tips over, unable to catch herself, and her legs go rigid, and she seems to stop breathing. Lily! Her legs jerk and her body shakes, and she stares somewhere far off in the distance, and I drop the pizza menu and run to her side. Lily! I shout again. If she hears me, she can't respond. I kneel and stroke her neck and try to support her head so that it doesn't slam against the linoleum. After a few beats of this, her legs start to run, stiffly, without bending, and she foams a bit at the mouth. The whole thing only lasts about 30 or 40 seconds, but it feels like an eternity. And when it subsides, I am hot with sweat.
Shh, shh.
I manage, worried that she will try to come out of it too quickly. I pet her gently in the way I do when she's restless at night, and I want to lull her to sleep. Eventually, she is able to focus on me, and I do my best to smile so that she won't be overly alarmed. But I oversell it, looking more than a little bit creepy.
"You look weird," she says.
I help her to her feet, but I don't let go in case she falls again. She tries to take a few steps, and I feel like an anxious father teaching his child to ride a bicycle without training wheels, holding on to the seat as they wobble awkwardly into balance. Lily takes 3 steps into a wall and falls into a seated crouch.
"Take it easy, will ya?"
She shakes her head and her ears flop.
"That was different."
"Yeah, it was. Don't do it again," I want to add. But I know she's not the one who did it. It was the octopus. It's a toss-up to say who's more shaken by the whole experience, her or me. I fluff the paw print blanket that lines her bed, get her settled, scratch her neck the way she likes it scratched, and beg her to try to sleep.
"What about pizza?"
She seems exhausted, like a boxer who just went 12 rounds instead of getting knocked out in the first. "You take a nap and I'll order the pizza, and when you wake up, you'll smell it and it will be here." She yawns and her jaw squeaks like a rusty hinge, and the only protest she makes is to remind me that she likes sausage, as if I could ever forget. "I know, you're a sausage dog." She falls asleep quickly and soundly. Her chest and soft belly rise and fall with each subdued breath. I sit next to her on the floor, my legs tucked close and my arms wrapped around them, and I make some of the eye rain she likes, but not too much. I don't know where the rage first takes root, my heart, my gut, my brain, my soul, but it has been metastasizing over the 4 days since the octopus first came calling. I look it directly in the eye.
"You."
I surprise myself with how guttural it sounds. There is no reply.
"You!"
This time I intentionally snarl. The octopus stirs. Its arms swoosh around Lily's sleeping head like they did late last night, and sluggishly it opens an eye. Horrified, I feel myself digging into the linoleum so as not to retreat. Holy fuck. What is this thing? It blinks at me drowsily as I advance. Slowly, as close as I dare, neither of us making any sudden moves. It speaks.
"If you're talking to her, she's asleep."
I jump back. Did I expect an answer? I don't know. I'm alarmed and disconcerted, and yet not at all surprised that he can articulate. He? He is a he, I think, with that voice. I think I knew this was coming. That one chapter was ending with another about to begin. That a foe this formidable would make himself heard. I'm talking to you. Since this is the first time I'm openly addressing the octopus, I should have given more thought to what I want to say. But this is all gut, all emotion. Whatever is going to come out is going to come. What can I do for you? His tone is bored, verging on annoyed. Fuck you, that's what you can do. I stare at him to wait for a reaction. The octopus feigns offense. There's no need to be vulgar. I stare the octopus down. Leave. The octopus looks for a moment like he's considering my directive. His gaze swoops up to the ceiling, hangs there for a beat, then falls back down to me. No. I stand, drawing myself up to my full height of 6 feet 2 inches, and outstretch my arms, making myself as large and as intimidating as possible. You're supposed to do this with bears, I think, and other frightening things. As a final sign of my physical dominance, I puff out my chest. Leave. Go. No! I'm sorry I can't. However you came, leave. There is an icy coldness to the exchange that chills the room 10 degrees. I'm afraid it's not that simple, he says. I hate his smug posturing. I'm sorry. I'm afraid. As if he wants to leave but can't. And the reason he can't is beyond his control. I won't let you win.
Win what, exactly?
You shall not pass! If I could strangle him, if I could get my arms around his 8 and wrench him from her skull, I would. I would eviscerate him and tear his flesh, rip his pieces into tinier pieces, and lay his guts bare. But I don't dare, not knowing how he's attached.
Are we playing a game?
I hate that I'm not getting a rise out of him. His placid tone is making me more irate. What do you want from me? I yell.
Nothing.
I turn and I punch the cabinet where I keep the baking pans. Inside they rattle and clang. What do you want from her? Pause.
I'm not sure I've decided.
I will do everything in my power to stop you.
It would disappoint me if you did anything less.
The only words I have left are Cate Blanchett's, and I say them with all the gusto of Elizabeth I standing tall in the face of the advancing Spanish Armada. I have a hurricane in me that will strip Spain bare if you dare try me. The octopus lethargically blinks again. Do you hear me, octopus? I gnash and growl and spit. My face is hot, and my fists are clenched. I have a hurricane in me!
Do you?
The octopus is unconvinced, enraging me to full boil. I'm serious, you prick. We're going to the vet in the morning, and I will do whatever it takes to stop you. I will max out every credit card at my disposal. I will beg, borrow, and steal. I will order every test, every pill, every measure, every treatment. The octopus blinks, but doesn't retreat. Skeptically.
Will you?
I would pull the walls of this house down on top of him. If he weren't attached to the fragile skull of my deepest love. In my whole life, I've never been more angry. Mostly because he is right. The Invertebrate. 5 years earlier. Stuck.
Come to San Francisco.
It's my sister, Meredith. When? I ask.
Day after tomorrow.
I look across the chaotic airport terminal at Jeffrey, who is trying to trade our two tickets for seats on an earlier flight out of JFK. I'm sitting 30 yards away on the grimy airport floor, our phones plugged into the only available charging station. We have been on the East Coast for 8 days. Christmas with his family, and then several days in the city. Just the two of us, to wander and explore and eat. But now the snow that was so beautiful just days ago is falling harder and harder, and people are trying to rebook their flights to get out ahead of the advancing storm. I don't know, we might be stuck.
Then get unstuck.
Meredith is uncharacteristically emphatic. What are you doing in San Francisco? An announcement blares over the airport speakers, but I can't make sense of it.
Where are you? I can barely hear you,
Meredith says. New York, trying to get a flight home. Why San Francisco? Silence at the other end of the line. Meredith.
I'm getting married.
My mouth drops open, and this kid sitting across from me, ignored by his own family, stares. Meredith explains how her boyfriend, Franklin, proposed on Christmas while they were visiting his parents in San Francisco. How they just decided to forego any period of engagement and tie the knot at City Hall before returning home to D.C. Technically, they're eloping, but since his parents are local, they are coming to bear witness. And since I live in Los Angeles, she wants Jeffrey and me to be witnesses for her side. When she's finished, she asks, "How was New York?" As if nothing else has just happened.
Good, it was good,
I say, my voice swallowed by another announcement, and a family pushing a mountainous pile of luggage on a cart with a rattling wheel. I can't tell if I'm lying or telling the truth.
I can't hear you,
Meredith exclaims. You're not inviting Mom? I ask.
You know Mom.
Yes, we've been introduced. The boy across from me lifts up his nostrils and sticks out his tongue. I make a face in return.
She's not one for ceremony. She probably didn't even want to go to her own wedding.
I'm not sure that's true. Although I wonder which wedding my sister is referring to. The one to my father, which I can't picture because there are no known photographs, or her second, the one to her current husband, which Meredith and I both attended.
Ted, can we count on you?
More noise.
Sure.
I can't hear you.
I raise my voice.
I'll see you in San Francisco.
A woman dressed like the Statue of Liberty stands in the middle of the terminal, and I'm curious how she'll get through security. I wonder if she's the same Statue of Liberty we saw just yesterday, handing out pamphlets when we impulsively hopped in line at the TKTS booth in Times Square. We refused whatever she was selling, and were rewarded with front row seats to the Broadway revival of Hair. At curtain, they called up the front few rows to dance on stage to Let the Sunshine In. Our Broadway debut. As someone who struggles at times not to be seen, it was exhilarating to stand on stage and feel the hot lights on my face, the audience still in darkness, but out there, waving my hands in the air. Life is around you and in you. Let the sun shine. Let the sun shine in. I could still feel the white heat of stage lights as we exited the Hirschfeld Theater onto 45th Street, spilling into Times Square. I could see the sunshine, even though it was dark and had started to snow the lightest, most magical movie-like flakes. Street vendors selling chestnuts, buskers banging on pickle buckets, dancing tickers with holiday stock prices, workers preparing Times Square for New Year's Eve. Everything seemed touched by light. Everything, that is, except Jeffrey. Jeffrey stewed under his own cloud, worried by the snow and the forecast for more. I convinced him to grab a slice of pizza with me by agreeing that we would eat it back in our hotel room. I ate mine perched in the window watching the city receive its gentle dusting. Jeffrey paced and checked the weather. He tried to call the airline, but after 45 minutes on hold, he gave up. I finally got him to come to bed by agreeing we could head to JFK at the crack of dawn. Now that we're here, I'm anxious to get home. I miss Lily. If we can get on this flight, we might even get home in time to collect her from the sitters and celebrate a little Christmas together. I have a stocking for her at home filled with chews, a stuffed squeaky toy, and a new red ball. Jeffrey is downright agitated. His desire is not to get back to Lily, although I'm sure he misses her too. His desire is for certainty, for a plan we can execute. His growing need to control every situation is kicking into overdrive. It's almost laughable watching him scramble in the face of a storm. I mean, how do you control the weather? Come on, Jeffrey. Life is all around you, and in you. Let the sun shine in. My phone vibrates on the floor, and I look down, thinking it's Jeffrey texting me flight options. But there's no message. Then I look over at Jeffrey's phone. He has a text message from his friend Cliff. When are you back? I want to play. Cliff. Do I know a Cliff? I think he's a friend of Jeffrey's he met playing online poker. I look over at the airline counter, but Jeffrey is nowhere to be seen. I scan the terminal left and right. No sign of him. I feel almost panicked when a shadow falls over me. It's Jeffrey, holding two coffees and smiling. Success. When we're in the air, Jeffrey pulls earphones out of his backpack and plugs them into his laptop. Are you going to watch TV? I ask, knowing he always has a few episodes of something downloaded for a flight. I must say it with an accusatory tone, because Jeffrey replies hesitantly, I was going to. We never used to watch much TV. We used to talk about our days, commiserate over the things that bothered us most, and laugh about the happenings that struck us as odd. But lately it has become a crutch. Our upstairs neighbor pulled me aside at their holiday party to say how happy it made her that she could hear the sound of laughter from our bedroom late at night. How well suited for each other we must be. I bit my lower lip to keep myself from saying it was Jeffrey watching reruns of Frasier. Jeffrey closes his laptop to appease me and rests his phone on top of it. Would you rather talk? I stare at his phone and think of the text message I saw, and suddenly it doesn't sit so well. When are you back? I want to play. I want to play means poker, surely. That much is innocent enough. But when are you back? Why does he have to be back to play a game that is played online?
When are you coming back?
Lily would ask me those words every time I had to leave her. The first time was 4 months or so after I first brought her home. She was fascinated when I pulled my luggage out of the deep closet in the second bedroom. As soon as I had the suitcase unzipped, she climbed pluckily inside, and since she wasn't yet fully grown, a few wrinkles of skin puddled around her seated butt.
What is this cozy box? This would make a great bed for me. I love its sides. And this elastic strap.
That is a suitcase. I have to put my things in it so I can travel.
Great. I'm already in it, so you're ready to go.
Sadly, I can't have you in it. It's for my clothes and shoes and shaving kit.
Why can't I be in it? I am one of your things.
I sat down beside the suitcase and scratched the back of her head between her ears. You are, in fact, my most treasured thing. She raised her nose in the air and squinted her eyes. But you're going to stay nearby and have an adventure of your own. Lily looked at me with her soulful, almond-shaped eyes.
We're going on different adventures?
She was tugging my heartstrings the way she tugged at my shoelace at the puppy farm when we were introduced. Slowly, but with purpose.
Your adventure will be fun. You're going to play with other puppies the way you used to play with your brother and sisters, Harry, Kelly, and Rita. Harry, Kelly, and Rita?
That's right. But other puppies whose names I don't know, but I'm sure are just as nice. The boarding facility I had selected was a ways outside the city, and it was clean and welcoming and alive. Dogs roamed indoors and outdoors on their own whim, and there was a special place sectioned off for smaller and younger dogs. Inside it smelled like pine. A woman welcomed us and did her best to allay our fears. Lily and I were both apprehensive.
Is this Lily? Welcome, Lily. I think you're going to love the other dachshunds here. Their names are Sadie and Sophie D.
Lily turned to me.
Are they the other puppies whose names you didn't know?
That's right. Except now I do know their names. They are Sadie and Sophie D.
They are not Harry and Kelly and Rita.
No, they are Sadie and Sophie D. Lily considered this for a moment before adding,
My mother's name is Witchy Poo.
I scooped up Lily and balanced her on my arm. They don't need to know that. The woman took the canvas tote from my shoulder that held Lily's blanket and food. I repositioned Lily so her paws were on my shoulder and I could whisper in her ear, I'm coming back for you. In a week. Don't ever think I'm not coming back.
When are you coming back?
In 7 sleeps, I am coming back for you. I kissed her on the top of her head and sat her on the ground. I handed her leash to the lady so that she was now in control of my dog.
Come on, she said. I'll introduce you to Sadie and Sophie D.
Then she turned to me. She'll be fine. I nodded. I knew this, but also not. Would she be fine? Lily stood and turned back to look at me, and we both swallowed the lumps in our throats. The lady opened the gate to the smaller dog's pen, and I caught a glimpse of the other 3 dachshunds. 2 of them were long-haired, and 1 was short-haired, like Lily. I imagined the short-haired dachshund to be Sadie, because she had a dappled coat, and looked most different from the other 2, who just happened to look like Sophie's. All 3 greeted Lily with wagging tails.
Hello! 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 I'm Sadie!
I'm Sophie!
I'm Sophie D!
Lily paused before her tail started to wag, and she entered the pen. Once inside, she disappeared in a blur of paws and tails and ears as the gate closed behind her. The last thing I heard was her distinctive bark.
I'm Lily!
In my car, I broke down in ridiculous sobs. How does she know I'm coming back? How does she know I didn't just give her away? Because she trusts me. Just as I should trust Jeffrey. There's a perfectly rational explanation for that text. I want to play means poker. I turn to Jeffrey and his laptop is back open with his earphones plugged in. I've drifted. I made a fuss about his watching TV and then promptly checked out. I take a deep breath and try to re-engage, tapping him on the shoulder, pulling the earbud out of his left ear. We each have a few days before we have to be back at work. How would you feel about going to San Francisco? I wait for him to react. I wait for his body to physically reject the spontaneity. I wait for him to keep the sunshine out, to make an excuse as to why he has to stay in Los Angeles, something to cover his playing with Cliff. But instead, he simply smiles and says, Okay. Backbone. My cell phone rings in an ominous way, sounding almost flat, the way it does when you know something is wrong before you answer the phone. I fumble to retrieve it from my pocket, and the call almost goes to voicemail before I can answer. There's no time for anything to be amiss. We leave for Meredith's wedding in the morning.
It's Jeffrey. Something's wrong with Lily. You need to come home. I look at my watch. It's a little past 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I am more or less on my way home anyway. I'm just leaving the grocery store, and the last thing on my list is to pick up our suits for the wedding from the dry cleaners. Can it wait 30 more minutes? I think of all the things that might be wrong with Lily. Vomiting, diarrhea. Neither pleasant, but neither the end of the world. Too many treats from her Christmas stocking. Limping? She once had a thorn in her paw, like the old fable involving Androcles and the lion. It took some gentle prodding to get her to sit still long enough to remove the craggly thing. Bleeding? Bleeding is easy. Just apply pressure. Jeffrey can be an alarmist. Whatever it could be can probably wait. She can't walk. You need to come home now. When I burst through the door, I find Lily in her bed in the living room, with Jeffrey sitting on the floor beside her. Lily looks frustrated and concerned when she sees me, and she doesn't get up, and her tail doesn't wag. The new red ball from her Christmas stocking sits motionless on the floor. Her inability to greet me in her usual way all by itself makes my stomach drop. What's going on, you two? I almost don't want to know the answer. In 18 hours, we are supposed to be on an airplane again. Let me show you, Jeffrey says. He gingerly lifts Lily out of her bed, in the heedful way he did the first few months we were dating, before they bonded, before he was confident in the proper way to do it. He places her squarely on the floor, and the back half of her body immediately wilts, her hind legs splaying sloppily to one side. They just give way underneath her. My heart sinks to depths normally reserved for my stomach, and it becomes difficult to think or breathe. I kneel on the floor next to them and tuck one hand under Lily's muscular chest and one hand under her soft belly. I stand her up again, supporting her with both hands. I almost don't dare to let go. Stand for me, Lily. I say it like a hypnotist giving a direction to an entranced person under my command. When I let myself remove the hand under her belly, her toenails scrape on the hardwood floor as her legs once again slip to the side. Come on. This time I'm pleading. Stand up for me, girl. Again, when I let go, the awful slithering of toenails on wood and the total wilting of legs. She almost tips over entirely before I catch her at the last second. What happened? Nothing happened, Jeffrey replies. Something happened, I insist before adding. What have you done? What have I done? Jeffrey is shocked. She was my dog long before we ever met, and while she has become his dog, too, over the course of our relationship, they don't have the same bond. He does not treat her with the same attentiveness, or, truthfully, the same permissiveness. And when he's displeased with her behavior, he is always the step-parent, absolving himself of responsibility by throwing his hands up and calling her your dog. This can't really be Jeffrey's fault, but I wonder just the same. Are you accusing me of something? I stare at Jeffrey. Am I accusing him of something? Even in this moment, I'm forced to wonder if my assertion is about Lily or the text message. I don't know. But I can feel Lily tremble in my hands. And I know immediately now is not the time. No. No, of course not. I hope not. I'm not. I placate him while I place Lily back in her bed, where at least she's supported by the cushiony sides. Just watch her while I call the vet. When I get our veterinarian's voicemail, it dawns on me that it is now 4 o'clock on New Year's Eve. I immediately dial the first animal hospital I can find a listing for, even though it's on the west side of town. When I explain the situation, they insist I bring her in right away, if they can do anything for her. There's a short window in which it can happen, and that window is rapidly closing. I hang up the phone, grab an old blanket, and wrap it around my girl. I lift her carefully and nod to Jeffrey,
Let's go. In the car, we hit a red light that I know to be a long red light, and I burst into sobs. My choices now, as I see them, are either having a dog with wheels for hind legs, or, possibly, letting her go. Without warning, without moving or standing or crouching, Lily poops into the blanket on my lap, and my sobbing becomes inconsolable. She's dying, my baby, right here in my lap. The light turns green. I yell at a distracted Jeffrey to go, and he steps on the gas. And in the chaos, I find a doggy litter bag in my jacket pocket, because doggy litter bags are in all of my jacket pockets. I have a fear of being caught without them. I clean up the blanket as best I can and drop the sealed bag near my feet. I know this bothers Jeffrey, but he doesn't say anything. And really, what other choice do I have? We both crack our windows for air. Jeffrey makes decent time across the city, and when I see a sign that says Animal Hospital, I make him stop, even though the address does not match the street number I've scribbled down on the back of a Target receipt. I must have transposed some numbers in haste. Inside, the waiting room is small and hot and chaotic, and I worry about having a panic attack. The nurse hands us a clipboard with papers to fill out, and I push it back at her and say, "There is no time for paperwork." Jeffrey apologizes for my outburst, which annoys me, and he takes the clipboard and a pen. There is only one free chair, and he takes it so he can write. I lean in an empty doorway and cradle Lily in her tattered swaddling. Soon, a doctor materializes for a consultation. And when I explain the situation, she tells us that we actually want the surgical hospital that's across the street and two blocks down. Tick tock, tick tock. Precious moments wasted. As we turn to leave, a woman who looks like the log lady from Twin Peaks, although I'm the one holding the log in the form of a paralyzed dachshund, grabs my arm and says, "Whatever they tell you, don't kill your dog." I want to tell her to fuck off, but I'm frozen speechless in my tracks, and tears start to well. She can still have a happy life if you let her. Instantly, this woman is my everything. I nod, and my eyes overflow with moisture, but Lily does not attempt to kiss my tears. And the part of my brain that knows I can't waste even another second unfreezes me, and I'm out the door. Jeffrey tears into the parking lot of the surgical center, cutting off several cars at my urging. Inside, they are expecting us, the last doctor having called ahead on our behalf. A surgical technician pries Lily out of my arms, and they rush her behind a swinging door. Before I can protest, she is gone. No one offers us paperwork. No one tells us to sit. No one tells me not to kill my dog. Lacking anything else to do, we stand in the middle of a large, sterile room surrounded by anxiety and tragedy, with nothing to look at but our feet. There's free coffee, but it's probably awful. And I know that I can't drink black swill when the rest of the world is sipping golden New Year's champagne. After a short but interminable wait, we're ushered into a private examining room. Lily is not there. There are two seats, so we sit. We fidget until a veterinarian enters. She has blonde hair and a kindly face, and looks too laid back to be a surgeon, but has such an authoritative air of command that I wonder if she served in the military. Based on Lily's neurological signs, she is most suspicious of a ruptured intervertebral disc and wants to perform a myelogram to determine the site of the herniation. I don't know what a myelogram is, and I know I don't have time to educate myself beyond the context that it is some test to detect pathology of the spinal column. And then what? And then, pending the results of the myelogram, Lily's best chance of walking again is surgery. Surgery. I'm taking this in as fast as I can. The sooner the better. Apparently there is no time to think. So we'll know if surgery is the way to go after the myelogram. In all honesty, I would make that decision now. She'll already be under anesthesia for the myelogram, and if it does indeed reveal a ruptured disc, it's best to perform the surgery right then and there.
So you need a decision now. The doctor looks at her watch.
Yes.
Decisions. Lately, they're not my strong suit. I think of the ways, recently, in which I've felt paralyzed myself. Should I quit my job to freelance full-time as a writer? Should I talk to Jeffrey about the doubts I have in our relationship? About the suspicious text message he received? Could Lily and I start over on our own? And how much does spinal surgery cost for a dog that is mostly spine? The doctor crouches in front of me and offers a half smile. She doesn't need to tell me things I already know. That this is always a risk with the breed. That purebred dogs come with these health issues, as they've been genetically mutated for purpose or show. Altogether, everything, anesthesia, myelogram, surgery, recovery, we're talking about $6,000. Now it's me who is left immobile. $6,000. I look at Jeffrey. I think of dwindling savings, of having just paid off all my credit card debt, of vacations that might not be taken, retirement accounts that won't get contributed to, of having to push my dreams of writing full-time back another year. It's your call, Jeffrey says. I can't make this decision. She's your dog. Your dog. I want to punch him. I want to punch everyone, except maybe the doctor who can save her. Why don't I leave you to talk it over for a moment? The doctor stands, and before I know it, I've grabbed the sleeve of her lab coat. She has a ball. It's red ball. She loves it. She'll play with it for hours, tossing it, chasing it, hiding it, finding it. She'll play until she's out of breath. And even then, she'll take it to her bed and fall asleep on top of it. She is alive when she's playing with that ball. If she... I can't even finish the words. Jeffrey places his hand on my shoulder as I'm reduced to tears again. If she can't play with that ball anymore, then I don't know what kind of life there is left for her. The doctor turns to me. She's not unmoved, but she's seen people wrestle with this decision before, and there's nothing so special about me. I continue through gasps and swallows of oxygen. I don't want you to think I'm a horrible person, that I would let money even become a part of this decision. It's just, I don't know what her life would be if she can't play with that ball. I plead with my eyes. Fix her. Save her. One nod is all that I need, and she studies me before giving it. She has heard me, and she's trying to communicate something. I'll be outside in the hall. It's not even necessary for her to go. Will you be the one performing the surgery?
Yes.
Another nod. She's telling me Lily will walk again. She's telling me she knows this, but legally can't say it because of ridiculous reasons like malpractice insurance. So she's telling me without words, in the way that hostages blink secret messages in videotapes that evade detection by their captors. I look at Jeffrey, who once again says, I can't make this decision. At least this time, he adds, but I will stand by yours. I look back at the doctor. My heartbeat is in my ears. The room is hot and smells like medicine. The fluorescents blink angrily, asking to be replaced. My head is spinning, but with adrenaline, not with dizzying thoughts. Now is when I have to start making decisions. Now is my time. I stand tall with my hands by my sides, and now I'm the one who speaks with authoritative command. Do it.
We'll take a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne.
We leave the animal hospital as soon as I agree to the surgery.
They almost insist on it. Since it's New Year's Eve, they are running with a limited staff and don't want to assign any of their already sparse resources to oversee a hysterical person in the waiting room. If the surgery goes well, they don't need me insisting on seeing her or overseeing her recovery. And I would. I would be like Shirley MacLaine in terms of endearment. It's past 10. My daughter is in pain. I don't understand why she has to have this pain. All she has to do is hold out until 10. And it's past 10. My daughter is in pain. Can't you understand that? Give my daughter the shot! If the surgery does not go well, I guess they don't want that scene to play out in their waiting room either. So we go home. Jeffrey stops to pick up Chinese for dinner, and I stay in the car and call Trent. He is already at some New Year's party, and I can't communicate the enormity of what is happening, and I get frustrated and just hang up. Alone in the car, and without really thinking, I call my mother. While the phone rings, I think about how every conversation with her feels incomplete, about how we talk around the perimeter of things, but never about the things themselves. What will this call accomplish? Why do I still need my mother? As soon as I hear her voice, I start crying, and I hate myself for it, because if she's not going to give me what I need, then why bother to call her? Being needy. Well, of course you're upset. She's your baby. Huh? I'm not surprised that she offers sympathy. I am just surprised at the "of course." Growing up, we had 4 dogs. Not all at once, but over the course of 18 years. None of them were my mother's babies. She had 2 human children, and that was quite enough. The "of course" is all I need, and I no longer feel ashamed. Of course I'm upset. Of course I'm feeling lost. Of course I have emotions. She's my baby. Even my mother can see that. When we finish speaking, I call Meredith. It's hard when talking to my mother not to spill the secret, not to share the added stress of having to attend a wedding, but I keep Meredith's confidence intact. Meredith is wholly supportive. We'll change your flights. Have you on standby. Get you a return flight home right after the ceremony. Whatever you need us to do, and of course we'll cover any costs. Hearing Meredith's voice makes it easier. But if you think you can, please come. I pick at some General Tso's chicken and poke at a steamed dumpling, but I don't have much of an appetite for anything other than vodka. We are supposed to be at a party thrown by our neighbors in a unit of our duplex above us. I send Jeffrey upstairs to give our regrets. The dull roar of the party is constant, and at times laughter bubbles over, reminding us that life is continuing outside of our anxiety, that seconds are ticking off the clock, marking the end of an old year and the start of a new one. But in our apartment, time has stopped. There's maybe something playing on HBO. Even it seems to unspool in slow motion. Until the phone rings. I'm not even aware I've answered it until the doctor's voice is in my ear. Lily came through surgery fine. I dry heave my relief. The myelogram revealed compression of the spinal cord over the 10th through 12th thoracic vertebrae. We took her directly into surgery and performed a hemilaminectomy over this area. I'm nodding as if I understand exactly what this means. I'm nodding for someone who can't see me, trying to listen but also play back in my head the confirmation that all this went fine. I try to repeat hemilaminectomy in my head, and it sounds like a child trying to pronounce aluminum, aluminum. Basically, we make an incision that creates a window into the vertebral bodies and exposes the spinal cord so we can retrieve the herniated disc material. Retrieve it and do what with it? Lily's procedure went without complication, and she recovered from the anesthesia uneventfully. Uneventfully? like being put under and myelograms and spine windows and aluminum surgeries are everyday phenomena in life.
Is she able to... Was the surgery a success?
I am suddenly aware that I'm standing, as if the doctor has walked into our living room. I have no memory of getting up. And now that I am up, I'm unsure of where to look or what to do with my hand that is not holding the phone. The news is what I want to hear, but somehow I'm ice cold, the warmth of the vodka having drained out of my limbs.
Animals that suffer this type of injury make most of their neurologic improvement over the first 3 months post-operatively. You'll notice some immediate improvement, but don't be discouraged if Lily's progress is initially slow. But I'm cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic that... There's a hiccup of laughter from upstairs, and I give a death stare at the ceiling.
Cautiously optimistic that she will recover.
Fully?
Cautiously optimistic. Stop saying that. Will she walk? We need to board her here for the next 72 hours to monitor her initial recovery and watch for any signs of complications. Our offices are closed tomorrow for New Year's Day, which means you can visit her the day after if you want to, but only briefly. It's not good for her to get too excited. Otherwise, you can take her home the day after that. Thank you, Doctor. It was our pleasure working with Lily.
She's not getting what I'm trying to say.
No.
I say it with import. Thank you. I hang up the phone and collapse on the couch and relay to Jeffrey what I was told, and when we can see her, and when we can bring her home. He looks at me, not quite knowing what to say. I guess we have a wedding to attend. I'm afraid there's no denying I'm just a dandelion. 8 times I was cowardly. 1. When I was 5 and my father told me to walk in a more masculine way, and I was so immediately overcome with shame that I did. 2. That time in the 7th grade when this popular kid with a French last name called me a faggot, and instead of standing up for myself, I thought of how faggot would sound in French, fagot, while wishing for the floor to swallow me whole. 3. When my parents divorced and people asked me about it, and I pretended I was glad. 4. When this guy in high school performed oral sex on me, and I told him afterward that it was not a big deal, because even though he might be gay, I was comfortable with my heterosexuality. 5. Deciding not to major in creative writing because I thought that the broader and blander communications was the safer degree. 6. When I ended one relationship by becoming so distant and cold that after months of trying to reach me and discover what was wrong, he was left with no choice but to break up with me. 7. When I didn't immediately confront Jeffrey about the text message I'd seen. 8. Every time I don't tell my mother that I love her because I'm afraid she won't say it back. And one time I had courage. 1. When I left Los Angeles for my sister's wedding, leaving Lily behind, boarded, in recovery, trusting her to heal. The Tonga Room and Hurricane Bar. I watch the low morning sun glimmer off the water as we take off over the Pacific. It's a short flight to San Francisco, and we're still getting in on New Year's Day, as planned. I ask the flight attendant for a ginger ale to pop an old pill I found in the bathroom drawer, which I'm hoping is Valium, but is probably Vicodin. Otherwise, I don't say a word. I'm grateful for my window seat. Normally I'm stuck in the middle, as Jeffrey refuses to sit anywhere but the aisle. But the flight to San Francisco is a smaller plane with only 2 seats in each row on either side of the walkway. If nothing else, I can stare out at the view below and not have to make eye contact with anyone. Eye contact is dangerous. Eye contact is a trigger. When we land and I'm able to turn on my phone, I have 2 missed calls. The first is from Meredith to see if we made our flight. And the second is the animal hospital calling to say that Lily has made it through the night and continues to exhibit good vitals. I listen to the second message 4 times for any hint that they are lying to me or glossing over an unpleasant truth, but I can't glean anything untoward, and I end up not calling them back. Meredith is waiting for us at baggage claim. She greets me with a hug, which I collapse into.
"You okay?"
she whispers in my ear. Okay, adjacent. I can be matter-of-fact with her, even today. We're only 18 months apart, and while I sometimes joke that my first 18 months were the best of my life, it's just that. A joke. Did you call Mom?
We're eloping, okay? If we invited everyone and made a big to-do, it would be a wedding.
I don't know why there's a weird feeling in the pit of my stomach about this, but there is. Is Mom everyone? I tend to obsess over the ways in which our mother is like every other mother, and all of the ways that she isn't.
Okay.
It's Meredith's decision.
But I'm glad you're here.
She and Franklin and Jeffrey and I manage lunch at a noodle house in Chinatown and check into our room at the Fairmont Hotel before I can't hold it inside any longer. I need a drink. It's almost 5 o'clock, if the give or take is 3 hours, and so we head down to the bar in the lobby. Some asshole is playing annoyingly plinky ragtime on a grand piano, but my aggravation doesn't trump my thirst, so I order a double vodka on the rocks. Meredith agrees to an impromptu bachelorette party, partly at my urging. A bachelorette party sounds like a good excuse to drink, as long as she doesn't have to wear a tiara or carry a penis whistle or anything like that. I apologize to Franklin. He's not invited. And I call my friend Aaron, who now lives in San Francisco, and who Meredith knows from years ago when we all lived in Maine. He agrees to join us for the revelry. 3 gay men and a bride. When Aaron arrives, he's as handsome as ever. For some reason, this is comforting. The beauty in life. And I fill him in on the Lily situation, and the impromptu nature of both the wedding and this makeshift party. We all need some celebration and some fun, I say. The lobby bar is not fun. I know where we need to go, Aaron says, and he leads us to the elevator.
We're already on the ground floor, Meredith offers. The front door is that way.
Shh.
He winks, taking Meredith's hand.
You and me, and I think they'll agree, are going down to the terrace level to take up residence in the Tonga Room and Hurricane Bar for tropical storms and Singapore slings.
Was that a poem? I wonder. It feels like he's using words from another language that I usually speak, but that now sounds foreign thanks to the double vodka and emotional exhaustion. When the elevator dings, Aaron corrals us inside and presses the button for the terrace level, and the car lurches and our stomachs dip as we head down. The Tonga Room is squarely underneath the Fairmont Hotel, and the Hurricane Bar is a Polynesian-themed marvel, situated around what must once have been the hotel's swimming pool, but is now a lagoon, complete with a rainforest-style thunderstorm every half hour. A barge floats on the lagoon, carrying a band that plays in between storms. The cane and rattan furniture and the tiki lights make it a tropical, tacky mess. In short, it's perfect.
Singapore slings for everyone, I say.
Waiting for our drinks, I fidget endlessly with my phone, as if the animal hospital will call. The battery is at 35%, and I have only 1 bar of reception. It dawns on me that it's still New Year's Day, and the hospital is closed except for emergencies, and they're only going to call if something is drastically wrong. But it's only after Aaron eases the phone out of my hand and sets it up